Bradford Cohen was a contestant on the TV show The Apprentice. When he turned down an exemption that would have kept him from being dismissed from the program, he turned down the exemption to try to provide some support for his team leader. And he thought that his own performance would keep him from hearing those dreaded words, "You're fired." But when he made it clear that he was turning down the exemption in favor of someone else, he realized that in Donald Trump's eyes, that was not a smart decision. Trump ridiculed Cohen for making that kind of stupid mistake, and Cohen was sent packing on that episode. Commenting on what took place on that program, a professor named Dr. Stacy Blake Beard from the Simmons School of Management wrote these words. She said, "The message of The Apprentice is that to the extent that you look out for yourself above all else, you will be rewarded. In that sense, the show is a microcosm of the real world. The degree to which you look out for yourself above all else, you get rewarded for that. Anything else is seen as being stupid, as being weak." Well, the Gospels really, in a sense, might be termed an extended episode of The Apprentice, where Jesus takes 12 people in 3 years trying to apprentice them about what it means to live in a world that's far more real than the one on which they are walking and eating and breathing. He talks about this reality called the kingdom of God. And he's trying to shape these 12 men to realize that in this kingdom, looking out for yourself above all else does not get you reward. Listen now for God's word to you as I share this story from the Gospel of Mark. James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to Jesus. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for men." May God bless to our hearing and to our living this reading from God's holy word. Well, many news organizations are providing extensive coverage, as we all know, of the presidential race. And they typically dub their coverage something like the road to the White House. And we are also painfully aware that this road is going to go on for another 13 months. It's already taken some rather unexpected twists and turns, and it's going to end finally on election night, when Americans choose who they want to occupy the Oval Office. Well, the Gospels spend an extensive amount of time covering what we might call the road to Jerusalem. In fact, we find Jesus beginning to take that road to Jerusalem as early as the 9th chapter of Luke's 24-chapter Gospel. So Luke doesn't spend 13 months, but about 15 chapters detailing this journey that will end also in an election. An election that will not decide who will occupy political office, but who will live, who will die. And Jesus already knows early on this journey that he's going to lose that election. It'll come down to the people casting their vote by voice for either himself or for Barabbas. For who will be set free and who will be crucified. Jesus knows he's walking into an election that's going to take his life. And he's trying to prepare the disciples repeatedly for that outcome. The Gospels say that on three different occasions, Jesus spells out for them what's going to happen when they finally get to the end of that road. One of the times that he does that is recorded for us just prior to the scripture that we heard, where Jesus says to his disciples, "We are going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." And immediately after this, before the sound waves themselves perhaps have fully dissipated, James and John come up to Jesus, who has just told them it's going to be condemned, flogged, beaten and crucified, and the first thing out of their mouths is, "Let one of us sit at your right hand and the other at your left in your glory." Now, if anyone deserved to hear the words, "You're fired," it would have been those two guys right then, right there. There's no sense of, "Oh my God, our leader is going to be brutally executed. Jesus, what can we do? We're here for you." No, their first thought is, "What can we get out of this?" They're not just being clueless, they're being heartless. It'd be like having one of your closest friends say to you, "I just came back to the doctors, I've got cancer, I'm going to die in 3 months." And the first thing they say is, "Can I have your Camaro?" I guarantee you that kind of response would get you failed in a seminary pastoral care class. And it's not just James and John who are tone deaf to what Christ is telling them. The other 10 we hear are indignant, not because they're upset that James and John are so insensitive, but because they beat them to the punch. They got first in line, which they all were hoping to do. Nobody would have blamed Jesus if he had said, "Oy vey, that's it. I'm sending you all." He must have felt here sort of the way that my calculus teacher felt in college as he watched me try to do differential equations on my test. "Has nothing I said to you gotten into your brain?" But Jesus, to his credit, keeps at it. Keeps teaching, keeps investing in these apprentices. And he uses James and John's faux pas to try to again teach them about what it means to really be an apprentice of his. Because he's fully aware that these 12 fishermen are people who have been steeped, cooked, brainwashed by the culture in which they live. That while they were Jews, for the most part, they live in a Roman culture that abides by very different principles than God's kingdom. A historian of Roman culture wrote these words. He said, "More than most, Romans lionized strength over weakness, victory over defeat, dominion over obedience. Losers paid a harsh price and got what they deserved. Roman politics became a ruthless game of total winners and abject losers." Now, the historian here is describing a Roman culture of 2,000 years ago, but doesn't that sound a bit familiar? How do we treat our losers? I heard today that U of M punter who fumbled that snap has received death threats. You go on media sites and you see people pouring out vitriol and hatred on this 20-year-old kid trying to play a game. Losers deserve to be condemned and ridiculed. Winners, though, get exalted and lifted up, not just in sports and in politics, in business, in all areas of life. We Americans love our winners and we tear down our losers. We're all about glory, prestige, and power. And James and John and the other disciples have, again, been conditioned to think that way. They also have their eyes set on glory and power and prestige. And they want to know, how can they get theirs? And they're thinking that maybe Jesus is the meal ticket to riding that train to the very top of the food chain. Now, Jesus also has grown up in that Roman culture, but he's not apparently brainwashed by what he's been observing. The Roman emperor and the worship of power has not somehow grabbed hold of his heart. He understands that while that might be the way in Caesar's kingdom, in God's kingdom, it is not going after glory and prestige and power that impresses God at all. That God is really about something far different than that and wants his people to have a far different objective. And so he's spending his time trying to teach the disciples to turn away from the Roman ideal of power and to begin to embrace the kingdom's ideal of servant. But it is a bumpy road. Indeed, we will find in this passage no clear depiction of the contrast, the absolute conflict between Roman ideals and God's ideals. And we find Christ at Jerusalem getting crucified upon those cross purposes. That what the world is about and what God is about are completely diametrically opposed. And Jesus, he is put upon that paradox, that opposition on the cross, experiencing the rejection given to losers in Roman culture. And Jesus was a loser with a capital L in the eyes of the Roman Empire. Stripped naked, ridiculed, shamed, dying a criminal's death. And yet, we knew that God had a far different opinion about all. Raising Christ from the dead and saying, no, this is the one who embodies and reveals the way God's heart appears. So Jesus is continually trying to impose, to teach, to allow his disciples to understand that. And he walks that road to servanthood, to self-sacrifice, because he understands that the world doesn't need another winner politically, another great military general. The world does not need another economic genius. What the world needs is a servant who will offer his life for others. A Messiah who will lay down his life as a ransom for the lives of God's people. And so to carry out his mission, to meet the greatest human need of all, to set us free from the consequences of sin, Jesus chooses to become a loser in the world's eyes. He chooses the way of humility, powerlessness, and self-sacrifice. He also, in a sense, gives up his own personal exemption from God. As the one person who really has not committed sin, he gives that in that all other people might be given the mercy and grace that God is offering. And all the task of offering self-sacrificial love was his alone to fulfill. Jesus does invite other people to begin to allow their hearts and their minds to be shaped by that same spirit of self-giving. And so he says to the disciples, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Look not to Rome for your example, says Jesus. Look to me. Do as I do. Live as I lived. And in this way, he lists up a couple of ways that we very committedly choose to identify ourselves with this cause of Christ. He talks about being baptized with him, drinking from that cup. The two ways that we as Presbyterians symbolize and celebrate the fact that we are God's people. When we are baptized, we say to God, we are willing to be so identified with Christ that his purpose, his mission becomes our purpose and our mission. That his way of living will become our way of living. Christ is not so much interested in people who will believe in him, but who will join with him in his spirit, in his mission, in his way of going about life. And when we are baptized, we say that we are so willing to join with Christ that we die to our old way of living, which is really about honoring our culture, and we become reborn into a way of life that's all about honoring the ways of God. And then when we drink from that cup that Christ talks about, James and John, we say that we are willing also to be broken and poured out. Just as Jesus Christ himself was broken and poured out. We also are willing to offer our lives in love, in mercy, and grace to all people. Jesus was not so much concerned about having beliefs about him, but adopting essentially this core value of being a servant to all. But trying to embody that, letting that really take hold, having one's perception being moved from what do I get to how do I serve is a radically different challenge. It requires a lifetime of following Jesus. It requires ongoing spiritual training. In some ways, it's like trying to become a Navy SEAL. I read yesterday an article called The SEAL Sensibility, written by a man named Eric Reitness, who was a former Navy SEAL. He was asked, you know, what is it that kind of determines which people make it through the Navy training, the SEAL training, which ones don't? He says the rigors that SEALs go through begin on the day they walk into basic underwater demolition SEAL training in Coronado, California. Recognized as the hardest military training in the world. The training lasts 6 months. So the classes include large contingents of high school and college track and football stars, national champion swimmers, and top-ranked wrestlers and boxers. But only about 10 to 20% of the men who begin that training usually manage to finish. What kind of man makes it through Navy SEAL Hell Week? It's hard to say. Someone who seemed impossibly weak at the beginning of SEAL training, men who puked on runs and had trouble with pull-ups, made it. Some men who were skinny and short and whose teeth chattered just looking at the ocean also made it. Some men who were visibly afraid, sometimes to the point of shaking, made it too. And almost all the men who survived possessed one common quality. He says, even in great pain, faced with a test of their lives, they had the ability to step outside of their own pain, put aside their own fear, and ask, how can I help the guy next to me? They had more than the fist of courage and physical strength. They also had a heart large enough to think about others, to dedicate themselves to a higher purpose. And I read that and I thought, I think that is what God is trying to do with his people. To try to form a contingent of folks who can step outside of their own pain and their own fear and to look to needs of others and say, how can I help the brother or sister next to me? To create a heart large enough to think about others, to dedicate themselves to a higher purpose. What a wonderful description of what it is that God is trying to form in his people. And having that happen really is a greater challenge than making it through the Navy SEAL training. The great poet William Butler Yeats once wrote, it takes more courage to examine the dark corners of your own soul than it does for a soldier to fight on the battle. Again, it was said about Alexander the Great that Alexander conquered the world, but could not conquer Alexander. That the world within is the place where the true battle takes place. And learning to be an apprentice of Jesus requires that we learn to do battle with those forces within us that say this life really is about what I can get out of it. It's really about looking out for myself. It's really about turning a blind eye to others who are in need or to a world that's hurting. It's really about simply building up my own portfolio, about keeping my family safe, about maintaining my own lifestyle. All those mindsets that keep us from radically giving our lives in service to God are the things that keep us from becoming authentic apprentices of Christ. And dealing with those fears, dealing with self-focus, really requires a tremendous amount of courage and trust that Jesus can do some great work with those who are willing to let Him do that. Christ is a far greater teacher, thank God, than my calculus teacher. He can take people who seem to be nothing but failing and somehow through His grace able to do something miraculous. In fact, He did it with James and John. Later on, John, who is only concerned about his glory in this passage, ends up becoming a great leader in the early church. He writes some letters to congregations, and one of those letters that we call 1 John, he writes, "This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down His life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and our sisters." He got it. He understood. The same man who was only concerned about his own promotion here understands that there's none different and greater way to experience life as a human being. To be a follower of Christ means that we lay down our lives for our brothers and our sisters. To me, that lies at the very heart of what stamps an authentic follower of Jesus. It's not about how fervently you hold on to your beliefs. It's not about how rigidly you try to enforce morality. It's really about, is your heart in a place where you are authentically able to be free to go and to meet in love the needs of other people? And I don't think it's an overstatement to say that people who walk the road to Jerusalem with Jesus are really the ones who carry the hope for our world. I will be following the road to the White House. I think who we elect to serve as leaders is important, but I also think even more important having people who are able to demonstrate in our world that they are apprentices, not of the American ethic or the business world, but apprentices of Jesus Christ, who alone shows us what it means to live in ways that bring hope and healing to our broken and fearful world. May we today remember that we have been baptized with Christ, that we have chosen to drink from the cup with which He drank. May we today, by His grace and by His power, live for Him always, today, tomorrow, and forevermore.